At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Buying health insurance is never going to be like buying a song on iTunes.
Nope, it's not. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, this is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, November 14th. I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl. It's lovely to have you with us. We're going to begin today at the White House, where President Obama had some bumpy moments in the briefing room.
We fumbled the rollout on this health care law.
He announced a change to the Affordable Care Act. Americans whose plans have been canceled under the new law will be allowed to keep their plans for about another year. But that depends in part on what insurers and state insurance commissioners decide to do. David Cutler is a professor of economics at Harvard, and he advised the president and his team on health care policy. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
I want to start by talking about the changes that the president announced today. Is there any real incentive for an insurer to keep offering one of these plans?
There is an incentive. I think a number of insurers will want to offer people a continuation policy. I imagine that the insurers, if they can do it administratively, will be interested in doing this. You know, and just to go back one second, the problem with the cancellations really dates back to the fundamental problems with the website. What people believe based on having looked at the data is that most of the people who are getting canceled are people for whom there will be an exchange plan that will be better and cheaper, particularly after the subsidies for them. So it was widely believed that what would happen is that people would be able to view the alternative and say, you know what? I'm not being canceled. I'm actually choosing to switch to something better. What's going on now is that people, of course, cannot see what they're going to get, and they can't calculate the subsidy. And so there they're getting letters saying, no, you're not going to have X, but they don't know what the alternative is. An enormous amount of this would probably have been eliminated just by having the website up and running.
When we think about the Affordable Care Act and sort of the web, if you will, of the way the ACA was meant to be constructed, getting a lot of different people who have not been insured before into the pool of people who are insured. If you delay some of the folks who have had, say, substandard plans for a year, if they are not getting in, how much does that impact everybody else?
It's a very good question. The big worry is that the insurers there would lose money and that in the future they would then say, well, we need to increase our premiums. If you can't get the people to ultimately come in the exchange, either because you can't get it working well enough or because people simply refuse to do so, then it's a very big issue because the premiums would have to go up. The government would be paying a lot of it, so it wouldn't fall on the individual so much, but they would not be serving their function of keeping people in a common pool so that millions of people can buy insurance.
So that's why there's this pressure to get people in and to get them in quickly.
Yes. Think about it a little bit like a door with only one way through it. The initial idea was to try to get everybody in at once. What the administration is saying is because of the disaster with the website, they don't believe that they can quickly enough get everybody in, and people are very concerned that they're not going to get in. So they're going to say, look, we're going to set up temporary arrangements outside the building. We're going to try and let as many people into the building as we can and get them into the building a little bit slower than we otherwise would have wanted.
You think it's fixable?
I do think it's fixable. If the website is predominantly working by the end of November, then people will be able to get coverage through the exchanges. People, based on the actions today, can stay in their policy if they want and will feel comfortable with that for another year, and it will have been very, very rough, but it still can be successful. If they can't do that, then the consequences get worse and worse.
David Cutler of Harvard University, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We are going to stay in Washington now. Janet Yellen, the president's pick to lead the Federal Reserve, got some quality time with the Senate Banking Committee today. More than 2 hours of quality time. And if her goal was to avoid making big news, avoid spooking the markets, well then, mission accomplished. So while she didn't say anything too unexpected, she did help us piece together something that's going to be very important if she's confirmed to the Fed job. What you might call the economic world according to Janet Yellen. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
That world doesn't seem that different from the economic world according to Ben Bernanke. Yellen right now cares more about unemployment than inflation. She wants the Fed to be more transparent, and she's inclined to keep interest rates low until the economy improves.
I think pursuing a policy of low rates to get the economy moving will best enable us to normalize policy and to get rates back to normal levels over time.
But Yellen is not a carbon copy of Bernanke. Norman Obst teaches economics at Michigan State.
One gets the impression that she would pursue much more expansionary policy for a much longer period of time than Bernanke would.
Senators asked Yellen about regulation, something the Fed is doing more of these days. She told Elizabeth Warren it's just as important as making monetary policy. And Yellen said the notion of financial institutions being too big to fail gives an unfair advantage to big banks. Yellen also talked about economic inequality, something she's written about in the past, according to David Wyman, who teaches economics at Barnard.
She's concerned about it. It's not really a matter that the Fed can directly address.
The Fed's tools are designed to be blunt, he says, to affect the whole economy. After the hearing, an economist with J.P. Morgan called Yellen studiously ambiguous. In a note to clients, he wrote, "If you only read the transcript, you'd be hard-pressed to distinguish Yellen from Bernanke." In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Wall Street was up all across the indices today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. This may come as no surprise, but you are being watched. Google, Facebook, the NSA. This is the age of big data. But small businesses monitor their employees, too, right down to their movements by the minute. From WLRN, Kenny Malone brings us working life under the company microscope.
Okay, it's about 4 in the morning, and we're about to start the day's deliveries with George.
George Varelis is a delivery truck driver for Miami-based Intermark Foods. He pokes his shaved head inside a box truck to check today's inventory.
Cheese, smoothies, a lot of frozen stuff, you know.
First stop, Publix grocery store. Varelis opens the truck, unloads the Publix order, on to the next stop.
Walmart. We're going to do a Walmart.
And so it goes. Drive, stop, open, unload. Drive, stop. Varelis has 18 deliveries today. And at virtually every step, he's being tracked.
We see George at this address, and the ignition is off, so he's making a delivery.
Maria Elena Ibanez owns Intermark Foods. She's looking at a computer map with a little truck icon. As George drives, the little truck moves, and all kinds of data pop up.
That he has been driving under the speed limit, the engine is working okay, stuff like that.
In case you're wondering, George is cool with being followed. He says it's part of the job. In the grocery business, you've got a window of time to deliver your food in the morning. Ibanez used to lose thousands of dollars from her driver's missing deadlines. She started tracking them and learned they were messing up the routes.
You have to have the good timing because of traffic. They leave my office at 4:30 in the morning. If they don't, see, another one.
Just then, an alert window pops up on the computer screen.
The same guy. Another heartbreak.
That's heartbreak. It was like the third sudden stop alert from the same numbered truck.
This guy's falling asleep, probably. I'm going to call him.
This isn't George, though.
No, this is another driver, 157.
You're lucky for now, George.
What makes this tracking possible is a technology called RideSmart. It was introduced by the Ryder company back in 2007.
It's a little box, and it basically sits inside the cab of the truck.
Dennis Cook runs the truck leasing side of Ryder. Right now, a little more than 1 in 10 of its trucks have the RideSmart box on board. It's an extra service. But Cook says it is becoming essential technology. It can reveal inefficient routes and even calls for help when your truck's overheating.
We got a fault code and called the truck off the road, and it turned out that the grill was caked with mud. And the driver said, you know, how did you guys know that? This is great.
But the technology may not be great for everyone. With the right software, employers can watch every keystroke, every screenshot, every single day, every word you say, every game you play.
I had a finance manager who just wasn't getting the job done, and I was wondering, what is going on? So we went to look. She was playing games all day.
Celeste O'Keefe wound up firing that finance manager. O'Keefe runs a small production company in Biloxi, Mississippi. With monitoring software, she discovered one employee writing a master's thesis on work time and another spending at least 2 hours a day on social media. Both were let go after warnings to stop.
I mean, people know the cameras are in stores and people still try to steal, and associates in work were doing the same thing, you know?
I assure you, employers and employees have different expectations of privacy.
Dale Morgado is a labor and employment attorney in Miami. He says there isn't a lot of case law out there about this. But just because you can monitor something, Morgado says, doesn't mean it's right, and it doesn't mean you won't get sued.
And frankly, the best way I tell the employers when I counsel them is, how would this make you feel if you were an employee?
Maria Elena Ibanez thinks tracking employees is humane, especially when your delivery guys are hitting the road just after 4 in the morning.
If one of my truck drivers falls asleep and kills somebody, how would I feel? This way I can detect him ahead of time. I said, this driver has a problem.
And so, back to that hard breaker on her staff. Ibanez picks up her iPhone and makes the call.
Hola, Rolando. María Elena, ¿cómo estás? Mira, ¿qué te está pasando?
She explains the whole thing, the alerts, the volume of them.
Bueno, okay, bye. He says, there's something wrong with the truck. That he didn't have a hard stop. And he says, no, the truck probably sending the wrong signal.
Ibanez isn't buying it, but she does think her message got through.
Of course. They know I know.
Just to be safe, though, she also told Rolando he has to come in to see her when the shift is over. In Miami, I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
Imagine someone offered you $3 billion
and you turned it down. I know. But that's reportedly what the mobile messaging service Snapchat has done. According to the Wall Street Journal, the company turned down a $3 billion offer from Facebook. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains why anyone would do that.
Snapchat has a bit of a reputation, if you know what I mean. Wink, wink. Basically, it lets you share a message or picture with your friends or boyfriends that'll disappear after a few seconds. But 23-year-old Snapchat user Evan McMullen says all of us feeling scandalized are out of touch.
I think it's kind of funny that everybody assumes Snapchat is just for sexting.
Nope, Snapchat isn't about racy photos, says Evan. For her, it's about sending a friend a picture of a dog in the meeting she was just in.
I liken Snapchat to passing notes in class. And Facebook is sort of like standing up in front of the class and making a presentation.
Okay, I'm starting to get it. But what makes Snapchat's founders willing to turn down $3 billion with a B dollars? The older of the two is 25. The company doesn't make money. Julie Osk is an analyst at Forrester Research.
We've got some optimistic and bullish entrepreneurs that think they've got something worth more than $3 billion.
Optimism or youthful over-optimism? Brian Weiser is an analyst with Pivotal Research.
There's so much that we don't know.
About other possible offers and what the company's investors want.
It's hard to really pass too much judgment.
Snapchat user Evan does have an immediate reaction.
If you were to Snapchat the owners of Snapchat about this decision, what would you send them?
I would probably send Evan Spiegel, the Snapchat CEO, a thumbs up. And say, you know, you go get them.
No word on what their moms think. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up, leaving the Thanksgiving table for shopping? Maybe it's for the greater good.
This is a huge time for a lot of folks who are out of work or who are hourly workers to make money that actually can make their holiday.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks rallied around the world today. Here at home, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 54 points, one-third of a percent, to close at 15,876. The NASDAQ gained 7 points, nearly two-tenths percent, ending at 3972. The S&P 500 picked up 8 points, four-tenths percent, to close at 1790. Fed Chair nominee Janet Yellen cheered investors by defending the central bank stimulus program. Retail was a mixed bag. Kohl's refunded 8% after reporting weak earnings, but Walmart ended the day up 0.25% despite reporting lower sales for the third straight quarter. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve issues its industrial production report for October. The Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for September. And Joseph Wapner, perhaps more popularly known as Judge Wapner of the People's Court, turns 94. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl because Kai's got jury duty, which is too bad because he would love this story. So it seemed like a great idea to them at the time. J.P. Morgan Chase offered up one of its top executives to answer questions on career advice and leadership over Twitter. Let's just say it did not go well. So much so, the bank had to call it off. As Marketplace's Sabri Benisher reports, there are landmines out there in social media, people.
Let's just cut to the chase. Here are some of the questions J.P. Morgan got via Twitter.
Is it true JPM stands for Just Pay More?
What's the best way to get bloodstains out of a clown suit?
Does Jamie Dimon pet a small cat and laugh ominously while he's ruining poor people's lives?
But maybe the most apt question was,
why did you think this would be a good idea?
It was basically as if Count Dracula decided to do social media engagement with the villagers. Robin Carey is CEO of Social Media Today.
When I'm, you know, told that it's really important to develop a personal brand, I always say, well, what if your personal brand is that you really are a jerk?
She's not saying J.P. Morgan is a jerk, but that it's a controversial company. And to make social media work, you have to listen, says William Ward, professor of social media at the Newhouse School.
If they were using social media and monitoring the conversations around their brand, you know, maybe they would have thought better of this.
Now, it's not impossible for a controversial brand to put itself out there, but it needs two things. First, fans who can shout down the negative people. Again, Robin Carey.
With enough time, they could have developed their own network.
And if you don't have fans, at least hire people to counter the negatives.
Bank of America is a good example. They have a huge team in New York sit in a room and look at what's being said about the bank and respond in an appropriate way in real time.
For its part, J.P. Morgan admitted the mistake. In their final tweet on the subject, they said straight up, bad idea. Back to the drawing board. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Britain's second largest city, Birmingham, can be one of the worst places in that country to grow up. It suffers from high levels of poverty, a rising jobless rate, and a social service network that is struggling to keep up. Plus, austerity measures there aren't helping. The BBC's Rob Brumby reports.
This is the Spark Hill Food Bank in Birmingham, and I'm surrounded by shelves of tinned and packaged goods donated to help people in desperate need. Sue, it's not her real name, is a mother of four whose state benefits have just been cut off because she was too sick to attend an appointment at a job centre.
I'm a single parent who left domestic violence. I'm in a break from my benefits because there was some sort of problem with my claim. That's why I'm here today at the food bank.
And that's tipped you over the edge financially?
Yeah.
What would happen if this place wasn't here?
I wouldn't be able to feed my kids.
At all?
At all. Even right now, I've got no gas and electric.
And you just have to make do with things that don't need cooking then?
Yeah. All my nails are breaking off, and I've lost a ton of weight. I'm just feeling quite lost sometimes.
The social indicators in Birmingham are worrying. High long-term unemployment rates, a third of children living in low-income households, and child mortality rates worse than Cuba. And all this in Britain's second city. Experts say smoking in pregnancy, poor nutrition, obesity, and a large migrant population with a poor health history are all part of the problem.
So in this room at the moment, we've got shelves full of food parcels that are ready.
Back at the food bank, the supervisor, Gareth Duffield, says the problems he sees are largely economic. Unemployment and stoppages in state support pushing people into hardship. The government wants to raise living standards by getting the unemployed back to work. Gareth says for many, that's not the first priority.
They don't have money to feed the family tonight and put food on the table. So their priority is to have a roof over their head.
Many social problems surface in the food banks sooner or later.
The last place I want to come is sit here and beg food. I feel embarrassed coming here.
Wayne, a recovering drug addict, had his state benefits stopped when he attended a drug treatment session instead of registering at the job centre.
But when they sanction you that much money, what am I expected to do? If this place wasn't here, I'd have to go out and steal food. It's as simple as that. It may sound wrong, but I've got no alternative.
Birmingham is struggling to regain its status as one of Britain's great cities with the help of some striking public architecture, like a new library and an exciting revamp of the main railway station. But just miles from here are some of the poorest communities in Britain, and dealing with the complex pattern of deprivation, poverty and poor health will take a different sort of vision. In Birmingham, I'm the BBC's Rob Broomby for Marketplace.
Maybe you're one of those phenomenally organized people who's already begun your holiday shopping. Or if you're like me, you wait until the last minute and then freak out. Either way, retailers want you. They've turned Black Friday, that post-Thanksgiving Olympic shopathon, into a six-day event. And now they're opening on Thanksgiving. Walmart, Best Buy, Toys R Us, and more. It's like a retail arms race. Carmen Wong Ulrich is the host of Marketplace Money, and she's here to talk about it. Nice to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you.
So you like to talk about how we live money. And one of the ways that people do it is they get up really early and they go to these Black Friday sales. And if they are going to Kmart this year, the doors will open at 6 a.m. on Thanksgiving morning. They're going to stay open for 41 hours. And some people are kind of freaking out, saying, wait a minute, Kmart workers should be able to spend time with their families. There's been a backlash. Why has there been this big backlash, do you think?
Oh, goodness. Aren't you cringing at a 6 a.m. opening time on Thanksgiving Day? Like, where did the holiday go? Now it's all about work. But I have to say this. This is a huge time for a lot of folks who are out of work or who are hourly workers to make money that actually can make their holiday.
And some of these workers are going to make money. Walmart says they're going to give a Thanksgiving dinner, 25% off a future shopping trip, extra pay. It sounds like some of these stores are responding to the idea that, yes, we know our workers are working on a holiday, and we get that maybe that's a familial hardship for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is an incredibly smart move. It really, really is. You have to recognize when you have the social media backlash, especially today, we know that that is viral, it's powerful, and they've addressed it quickly.
I have to ask you, as our personal finance expert, from the shopper side of things,
right,
do people save money in these sales?
Oh, Lizzie, see, this is the illusion. No, not really. Here's why. Because it's mostly about supply and demand. What happens is that Black Friday, Cyber Monday is really for those things that are the top hottest list items, and those do go quickly. But if you really want the most substantial discounts for your holiday shopping, especially on things like electronics and big ticket items, you're much, much, much better off waiting. It doesn't have to be a game where you have to show up with a horde of people and camp yourself outside.
it feels like this thing that used to be a day is stretching on and on and on. Why this trend to have it be what feels like a long shopping season?
Basically, they can capture more shoppers. Also, retailers are trying to balance the web here. It's a real catch-up game because every single year, those online shopping numbers really get higher and higher.
So if you stagger these things out, does that actually mean that there are fewer crushing mobs beating down the doors one day? Or is that going to happen no matter what?
Yeah, the hordes, I'm hoping, will be a little bit smaller this year. But of course, retailers want to see more. They feel very nervous about the fact that the government shutdown really shut a lot of people's wallets. So they want more people to show up. And this is their initial push to say, please come shop on Thanksgiving. You're hopefully your day off.
Carmen Wong-Ulrich is the host of Marketplace Money. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Lizzie.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, journalism is an industry filled with legendary names. Edward R. Murrow, Martha Gellhorn, and this guy.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy?
Yeah, that was Ron Burgundy, the fictional Anchorman of the movie with the same name, Anchorman. And as of today, Ron Burgundy got a spot in the Newseum in Washington, along with real-life war correspondents and dogged investigators. A Newseum spokeswoman told the LA Times that the movie had a societally relevant message about how hard it was for women to become news anchors when faced with sexists like Ron Burgundy. All I have to say is, you stay classy, San Diego. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.